everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is Nick.
And this is another Secret Wars Saturday episode. It's episode 394, counting down to that big episode 400. We're going to do something special on episode 400, just so everyone knows. We are going to each give our secret origins of how we started collecting comics, and we'll let you know how you can start collecting or reading. Either way, just because you read comics doesn't mean you collect them. Just because you collect them doesn't mean you read them. There's different aspects of the hobby, but we'll let you know how we got started, give you some advice on getting started yourself, and some books that we think are great places to start for certain characters. So look for that coming up really, really soon. Today's episode, as I said, Secret Wars Saturday, we're going to be talking about the books that cross over with Secret Wars 2, number 3, that awesome issue that Nick and I talked about recently with the Beyonder going on that crash diet, burning off the energy of his big fat belly.
And getting a rad haircut.
Yeah.
And getting, clothes.
Yeah, getting Michael Jackson mod, remember? It was the mod look. So let's start with Avengers 260, because this actually crosses over where, like, within the book, right? Like, Avengers 260 happens between panels of the actual issue. We saw the Beyonder go to the Avengers mansion, meet Jarvis, find out that the Avengers were out in space, and teleported himself to where the Avengers were. And then we saw that he came back to the streets of New York, very miserable, feeling like he had screwed up. So all that takes place in Avengers 260. I will say, two of these three issues that are crossovers today don't cross over in huge ways to Secret Wars 2, right? Like, the Beyonder is clearly a part of the entire narrative and story that takes place in Daredevil 223. He's less a part of this story in Avengers 260, and even less a part of the story that happens in Hulk. Yeah, so Avengers 260, let's give the creative team really quickly here. It's written by Roger Stern. We've got breakdowns by John Buscema. We've got finishes by Tom Palmer, and colors by Christy Shields. So the issue opens up with Star-Lord. Again, a lot of dialogue boxes, a lot of exposition.
But Fire Lord.
What's that?
Fire Lord.
Did I not say Fire Lord?
I said Star Lord.
Star. Yeah.
I'm like, I actually know who he is.
I have Chris. Yeah, I can't believe I got that wrong. Because Fire Lord's actually one of my favorite. He's visually, he's so cool. As far as character wise, he's kind of annoying because he's very pompous. But I think that's as he's supposed to be. But yeah, Fire Lord, apparently he had been recently spending a lot of time with the Avengers. And when the Avengers recently agreed to team up with the Skrulls to fight against Nebula and her mercenaries, that was a bridge too far for Fire Lord. His planet had been destroyed. Xandar it hadn't been destroyed, but it had been attacked many times by the Skrull Empire. And so he kind of considered the Skrulls to be mortal enemies of Xandarians and himself. So when the Avengers agreed to team up with the Skrulls against Nebula and her army of mercenaries, he's like, nope, I'm done. I'm out. So he actually goes back to Xandar to check on them. When he arrives, he finds out he sees that it's been decimated. Thousands are dead. And he finds the queen still alive, trapped under some wreckage, and finds out that all the damage was caused by Nebula and her mercenaries. So this would be what the grown-up people call irony. So obviously Star-Lord, or Fire-Lord, rather, who has a massive temper, now is on board, right? Skrulls, no Skrulls, whatever. He's going after the army of mercenaries and Nebula herself. And it's interesting what the queen says. Like, why did Nebula and her mercenaries attack Xandar? Oh, they were in the way. So clearly you can see where their motivations are. His mercenaries don't care. Nebula doesn't care. They'll kill anybody. It doesn't matter. Life is meaningless to them. So,
Is Xandar the home of the Nova Corps in the comics? Yeah, at this point.
Of the what?
The Nova Corps.
At this point, no, I don't think so.
They came up with that later.
Yeah, because I mean, they would, if the Nova Corps had been there, they'd have been able to defend Xandar. I'm not.
Is this pre-Infinity Gauntlet too? I think
this is pre-Infinity Gauntlet for sure.
Okay, yeah, cool.
And you know, I'm not that versed in the cosmic corner of Marvel, and then add that to the fact that I haven't read much Marvel in the last 10, 15 years, then yeah, I really, really am not well versed, other than Galador and the Space Knight. That story I do know. So anyway, the scene shifts to the Avengers and the Skrulls. They're planning how they're going to attack Nebula. And not only does Nebula have this mercenary army, she also stole a giant H, a giant flying H, known as Sanctuary 2, that was designed and built by Thanos. So you can imagine how powerful of a warship that is.
I'm just going to step in just every now and then. Because, yeah, they use Sanctuary 2 very recently in the films. And it's interesting how they improve the design while keeping the aesthetic of it being an H.
It doesn't look like an H in the movies?
It does look like an H, but it's... I was like, why is the ship built that way? But they updated it so it's not just like a simple block H floating through the sky.
You would think it would be a big T for Thanos, not an H.
And they kind of flip the orientation of it so it looks more like a spaceship. So it's like an H on its side.
An H for hells yeah. This is a cool ship.
It's not standing for Sanctuary 2.
Maybe that's what it's – maybe it's supposed to be two Roman numeral, you know, like two eyes. It's like Roman numerals. So – anyway, within the giant flying H, we see that the mercenary army is preparing themselves for battle. They've detected something in subspace and it appears right before them. And it's actually just this version of a cell phone or some kind of a message, an Instagram message maybe. Because it's a comm unit and it's got a Skrull and Captain Marvel on there offering the chance for Nebula and her army to surrender. And Nebula's like, what are you talking about? This is my reply. And she blows it up with a shot from her wrist blaster. The Avengers felt it was, and the Skrulls, not all the Skrulls, but the commander of the Skrull army felt that it was important to offer them a chance to give up. Because the battle obviously is going to cost many lives. And from the Avengers' perspective, they don't want to see any loss of life. And from the Skrulls' perspective, you know, they're at this point in Skrull history, their homeworld's been devoured by Galactus. And, you know, they're kind of scattered to the stars. And they don't really have any of their species to waste, right? They want to preserve as much of the Skrull culture and they want to preserve as many Skrull lives as they can, so they don't really necessarily want to battle either. If they can get Nebula to agree to surrender, then that they think that's for the better. You know, that's for the good. I don't know why anybody thinks that she'll actually do it, and indeed she does not. She rejects the offer. So the battle is joined. The Skrulls in their saucers, the mercenary armor in their ships. We've got Hercules just wearing a helmet and his little bikini briefs, jumping from ship to ship, destroying ships in space. We've got Captain Marvel turning into light form and trying to get through the shields of Sanctuary 2 to get in and do some damage up close and personal. We've got Black Knight flying on his atomic steed, cutting open ships. We've got Star Fox in a ship of his own, fighting against the mercenaries, and we've got Captain America. He's still back on the kind of the flagship of the Skrulls. They're waiting for Captain Marvel to bring the shields down so they can get in to the Sanctuary 2 and hopefully capture Nebula and her lieutenants. And meanwhile, we see Nebula gather up a couple of her lieutenants. And she's kind of worried. She's like, the Skrulls are clearly powerful. They have powerful allies. We can't use our most powerful weapons that exist on Sanctuary 2 without dropping our shields and making ourselves vulnerable. Then we see Fire Lord show up. He's trying to get through the shields as well and starts concentrating his power on one particular area of the shields. And the guys on the ship, the mercenaries, are like, let's focus on that hot spot because we can't handle much more of this barrage on our shields. And they basically kind of unleash the equivalent of a solar flare from the shields. And it hits Fire Lord pretty hard and knocks him into a nearby moon. And as he's trying to recover, we see that a stranger shows up and asks him, hello, are you an Avenger? Meanwhile, the battle of the Avengers continues, and Captain Marvel manages to finally bring the shields down, but she's pretty much exhausted herself, and she actually retreats to the ship that Wasp is piloting. And meanwhile, Captain America and the Skrulls board Sanctuary 2, with the Skrulls taking the appearance of some of the Avengers, and one of them taking the appearance of Thanos, there to reclaim his Flying H. And after they defeat several of the mercenaries that are trying to repel the boarding party, all the Skrulls revert back to their form, saying they see no further use for these disgraceful and distasteful forms. And Captain America's like, oh, suit yourself. Come on, we got a lot of decks to cover. And then we see that the person that showed up on the moon and is helping Fire Lord back to his feet is the Beyonder, asking if Fire Lord is an Avenger, looking for the Avengers. Fire Lord tells him they're out there trying to recapture Nebula's ship. And Beyonder's like, is that important? Fire Lord says, what's important is putting an end to Nebula. And then he proceeds to pass out. Very, very un-Fire Lord-like. So the Beyonder decides, well, I need a cool costume if I'm going to be an Avenger and go and help them. And he creates this truly awful-looking costume with pretty much the biggest shoulder pads I've ever seen. The shoulder pads are so big, they almost reach over his head. It looks completely ridiculous, I have to say. And, you know, John Buscema is very much a legend in the comic industry, and rightfully so. But, man, I'm just not feeling this one at all. This design's pretty awful. And maybe he's just trying to show that the Beyonder really doesn't have any idea what's functional, what looks good, you know, and no kind of human aesthetic whatsoever. So
I figured that was part of the purpose, was like the Beyonder's like, well, I need to look sweet. And he makes something really weird, even for the 80s. And you're like, okay, Beyonder, over the top again.
Yeah, 80s, shoulder pads are a thing in the 80s. So I guess he decides, I need shoulder pads. But
being well, that was like it's some kind of mantis head that could like just close over him.
Yeah, it's truly awful. So the Avengers are still on Sanctuary 2. They're knocking out mercenaries left and right. Star Fox actually attacks Nebula and mentions that Star Fox mentions he's there to reclaim what's rightfully his, as at this time Thanos is dead, one of the many times Thanos has been dead, and he's claiming the right of, you know, the blood right of the ship, right? He's like, this ship was built by my brother. And then Nebula says, I have as much right to it as you. It was built by my grandfather. And that really shocks the heck out of Star Fox. At this time, nobody had known that. Like, that hadn't been revealed, that Nebula was actually related to Thanos. So that...
She's his granddaughter?
His granddaughter, yeah. Is that not like that in the MCU?
In the movie, she's his adopted daughter. Mm. Like Gamora. Like, she was taken, and then he made them fight and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, here she's his granddaughter. So, Star Fox is overwhelmed by one of the lieutenants of Nebula, just because he was, like, so shocked he didn't see the psionic attack coming. But then the Beyonder shows up with his giant shoulder pads, and basically it appears that he disintegrates Nebula and her lieutenants, but actually he tells Star Fox that he just removed them from the galaxy. He's like, gone? Gone where? He's like, you appeared to oppose Nebula. You're an Avenger, right? I removed them from this galaxy. Isn't that what you wanted? Star Fox is like, no, are you insane? He's like, no, but the Flaming Man said, Flaming Fire Lord, did he put you up to this? And then the rest of the Avengers show up. They're all yelling at the Beyonder, like, what did you do? She should have to face justice for all the people that she killed. You know, you made a huge mess of things. And the Beyonder's like, I didn't know. He's all distraught. And he disappears. And again, I have to say, here we go again with this trope that has played out in Secret Wars 2 series so far. That the only people that give the Beyonder the time of day or attempt to understand him are like regular people. Whenever he interacts with the superheroes, they just like pile on and drive him away because they're being so antagonistic, right? Like, take the time to talk to the guy for like 2 seconds and could be like, Beyonder, bring Nebula back, right? But instead, they like jump on him and he just disappears. Great, now where's he gone? Well, what do you expect? You know, this is like a little kid in a way. And you guys like browbeat him. Of course he's going to run away. He totally could have brought Nebula back. I mean, you're superheroes, right? You're trying to save lives. You're trying to make the world and the universe a better place. This guy wants to become an Avenger. Think of all the good the Beyonder could do. But you're browbeating him and he runs away.
Yeah, I mean, Cap doesn't really realize it's the Beyonder until he's gone. Well, and even then, he's not sure. Yeah,
he's not really there. It's the other one, you know. But the Wasp is there.
That's true. She was,
and Captain Marvel. They were both on, you know, the planet Battle World.
So but they've never seen the Beyonder dressed like a weird-looking dude from the 80s.
That's true. That's true. But again, I mean, he was trying to – he does say, I'm trying to help. And, you know, Captain Marvel just yells at him, for someone who came to help, you sure made a mess of things. Like, chill out, people. Take a chill pill, you know, to borrow a term from the 80s. But instead, yeah, he runs off and the issue ends with Star Fox thinking, I must know if Nebula's claim was true. She must be found.
And now the Beyonder is someone else's problem.
And yeah, the saga of Beyonder continues in Secret Wars 2, number 4. The Avengers Intergalactic Adventures heat up in Avengers Annual 14. And Secret Wars 2, number 4 continues in next issue's crossover, Earth and Beyond. So, yeah, this issue was okay. It's a little bit of its time. It's very 80s in its dialogue. The art by Buscema is great. Again, he's, you know, a really classic artist. And, you know, the rendering is awesome. I always enjoy seeing Fire Lord because I think he's a cool visual, if not, as I said, an annoying, pompous character. Nebula, for my taste, was always, especially early on, was very much a mustache-twirling villain. You know, she was bad because she was bad. She was bad because she was Thanos' granddaughter, not for any motivations on her own. But the cover's really cool also, with kind of a, I don't know, a double exposure of Nebula's face over the flying H. So that, that was cool as well. But yeah, it's very much of its time. But it does give you a good feel of what this era of the Avengers feels like. So if you're digging this kind of team with Captain America, Wasp, Hercules, Star Fox, Captain Marvel, and Black Knight, if you enjoy this issue, you're going to enjoy a long run of the Avengers from a good, like, I don't know, 240-ish all the way up through the 290s, where it's kind of this creative team on the book. What else do you have to add, Nick?
I just thought it was fun to see a lot of the characters that are now becoming important in the MCU that I haven't seen yet in the comics we've read. And does this precede Secret Invasion, I assume?
Oh, yeah. It very
okay. Because I didn't know we saw the Skrulls much before that, let alone knew they could shapeshift.
The Skrulls were, I mean...
Well, them and the Kree are old, I know.
I think Fantastic Four, issue 1 or 2, the Skrulls first appeared. Yeah. That's a classic.
How come Secret Invasion caught everyone by surprise if they knew Skrulls could shapeshift this whole time?
Well, there's actually – so the Skrulls – well, because they weren't necessarily enemies of humanity. So that's part of it. But
so they didn't suspect them.
The Skrulls, like – I don't remember if it was the very first Skrull story or definitely an early one where they had come to Earth and they got involved with the Fantastic Four. And then Fantastic Four showed them – because they were thinking about maybe conquering Earth, and the Fantastic Four showed them, like they tricked them somehow into these four Skrulls thinking that they were like Earthlings were like really, really powerful. So the Skrulls are like, well, we can't recommend an invasion of this planet because they'll defeat us. They'll defeat our whole empire. We don't want them as enemies. So they turn into cows. They shapeshift into cows in order to await. And then they're going to call home and they're going to await the, you know, their ship coming to pick them up, right? And then what Reed Richards does is he gives them amnesia so that they'll just live out the rest of their lives as cows, right?
Oh, God.
Right?
Reed's a dick.
Yeah, and so that was the Skrull story for like the longest time. And then I don't remember who it was, but somebody years and years and years later took that idea and wrote a story about some guy gaining some powers because he ate like he ate Skrull hamburger, basically. What do you think about that? It's really gross, right? Like, so they thought this was a regular cow. They slaughtered it. But what the guy actually ate was like Skrull meat and then got some kind of powers or whatever. I can't remember exactly the details, but I remember that being a thing. It was pretty funny for somebody to go back and pull something that deeply. And I want to say that story, the Skrull hamburger story, is from like the last 15 or 20 years as opposed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, as opposed to the Skrull story, you know, from 50 years ago. So
it's also interesting, yeah, because we'll be seeing the Skrulls in the MCU next year. So,
oh, are they in Infinity War 4? Or
no, they're going to be in Captain Marvel. Okay, oh, Marvel. We assume that means they'll end up in Avengers 4, maybe. But
yeah, I actually first encountered the Skrulls in an issue of ROM Space Knight. I think it was ROM 50. That was the first time I saw the Skrulls. But yeah, they've shown up over time throughout the Marvel history, and they're a pretty prominent alien race in the Marvel universe for sure. All right, let's talk about Incredible Hulk number 312. This is written by Bill Mantlo. This is right in the middle of his giant run on Incredible Hulk. I think he wrote it for like 6 or 7 years, a really, really long run. The art is by Mike Mignola and Jerry Talak. And it's interesting, like most people are going to know Mike Mignola from Hellboy. Mm-hmm. But if you look at this art, it's very different from what his Hellboy art looks like. He also does a lot of the covers during this run. And his cover work is a little more reminiscent of what the Hellboy look is. But at this time, he's writing for illustrating for Marvel, rather. So he needs to have a little more of a conventional style. And then a lot of that's going to have to do with probably because he's probably just doing the breakdowns, and Jerry Talak is probably doing the finishes. So that's going to affect the way the style looks as well. We've got Bob Sharon on colors and Jim Novak on letters. And this is a story, as I mentioned, that the Beyonder is really not a very big part of. It's basically an origin of not necessarily the Hulk, but of Bruce Banner himself. Like, it goes back to the day of Banner's birth. Mantlo's really adding in a lot of backstory here about what Bruce's childhood was like, how abusive his father was, how his parents didn't have a great relationship. And it's pretty interesting as we see Bruce throughout the story, even as a little baby, there's always this Hulk like aura framed around it to kind of remind us this is really the origin of the monster, if you think about it. The loneliness and the abuse that Bruce Banner suffered as a child contributed to that pent-up rage that eventually gives birth to the Hulk when Banner is exposed to the gamma radiation. So,
well, it's interesting. So this is all canon, officially? They added this to his origin?
Well, it was at the time.
Because Ang Lee used this for the first Hulk. The one that's not a Marvel Cinematic Universe, a little bit, where the dad was like, oh, there's already the dad already did some experimenting on him, so there's already a monster inside, and then like the gamma bomb just let it out more than created.
Well, the dad didn't experiment on him. The dad was always doing atomic research and was worried that he had mutations within himself that he passed on to Bruce.
Yeah, and I think they kind of twisted that. Interesting. I thought that came out of nowhere for the Ang Lee movie, but it's interesting. It has origin somewhere back in the 80s.
You can't defend that Ang Lee movie in any way whatsoever.
No, I thought he made it out of the blue. It's interesting that some of it came from this.
It's god-awful. It's
terrible.
It's always been part of canon for Hulk that Banner had a very troubled childhood. That he came from a very abusive household. His father was an alcoholic. His father was a psychopath, basically. I mean, all the guy cared about was himself. He had no business being married, let alone birthing a child. He just wasn't a good person in any way, shape, or form. He was just a scumbag. And he was very abusive to both Bruce and Bruce's mother. And so that's always been part of canon. Now, whether or not it happened exactly like this, you know, different stories. Tellers are going to tell it in a different way. Peter David certainly drew on this in his Hulk run. But it's an interesting narrative and very much worth reading if you're a fan of the Hulk. Because as I said, it starts with the day Bruce was born. We fast forward to after he's finally able to come home from the hospital after several months. We see how much his mother loves him, the resentment that builds immediately from his father. He thinks to himself, look how she fawns over him. All that attention used to be mine and mine alone. Like, what the heck is wrong with you that this is your own son and you're jealous of your wife's love for him? Like, yeah, you're not a good person. And we see that as much as Bruce's father is able, he takes Bruce's mom away. They go out to symposiums and just doesn't – he tries to prevent that mother-son, mother-child bond from forming. And Bruce is left in the hands of his nursemaid, who to his parents, you know, appears capable and kind. But as soon as they leave, she's like, I'm all, you know, I'm only doing this because it's a job and I need a job. Shut your trap. You know, clearly mean and abusive as well. So poor Bruce is not left with really much of a nurturing environment. That being said, his intellect is clear right from the beginning. We see a scene at Christmas where he opens the Erector set from his mom and is able to build something at 4 years old in a matter of minutes. When his father discovers it, he kicks the Erector set, and Bruce's mother comes running, wondering what all the commotion is. And that's the first time that Bruce's father actually is physically abusive. You know, the fault was mine. I intend to correct my mistake now. And he, you know, basically saying he's going to kill Bruce, and slaps the boy as well. But the mother is able to intervene and keep the father from doing any, you know, from killing him, basically. I was going to say from doing any long lasting damage, but that's not the case at all. Clearly there's long lasting damage as the father starts calling Bruce a monster. So then the scene switches to Bruce in high school, very introverted, very much keeps to himself. And we also learn that Bruce's father killed his mother. And we see Bruce's aunt is there, and the headmaster of the school is expressing his concerns to Bruce's aunt about the fact that he shuns his fellow students and is shunned in return, cares for nothing but his studies. And his aunt remarks, yeah, that's part of, you know, the terrible childhood that he had growing up. And the headmaster says, you know, I expected as much, but whatever rage Bruce felt over the mistreatment from his father, he's internalized it. And, you know, he worries about the long-term consequences of that. Meanwhile, Bruce is subjected to pranks from his fellow students because he is so smart and they're threatened by him. And because he's so introverted and hasn't made friends, there's no understanding and there's no empathy there. And it only serves to push Bruce further into himself. Later still, we see Bruce at the graveside of his mother. It's the anniversary of her death, and her father is his father shows up as well. We learn that his father was able to plead to temporary insanity and get placed in a mental hospital. But we see that he hasn't changed at all despite being released. And he still feels that there's evil inside Bruce, and he's going to make him pay. And he says Bruce is a mutant. And once they realize that Bruce is not even human, he can prevent Bruce and his radiation spawn genius from ever harming humanity. And Bruce makes an excellent point here. He's like, you're mad. There's nothing wrong with me except that I'm smart. If I was a mutant, my intelligence wouldn't have manifested until adolescence, and I was always smart. So as the story moves forward, it starts getting into familiar territory for fans of the Hulk. He arrives on the Gamma base. He meets Betty Ross and Thunderbolt Ross. Thunderbolt is as distasteful as ever. Just, again, not a good person, not a good human being. And certainly not a good commanding officer either. I've never believed that he was. He doesn't listen to anybody but himself, to the detriment of if he wasn't such a dumbass, he could have accomplished much more instead of constantly alienating people and being so pig-headed and bull-headed. I think he's a terrible character in the Marvel Universe. Never have liked him at all. But we eventually see the origin of the Hulk as many of you have seen in the past. Rick Jones drives his car out onto the testing site. Banner runs out to try to save him, telling his assistant to halt the test. His assistant wanting to steal the Gamma plans for the Gamma bomb and sell it to his own Russian government does not halt the test. Banner is subjected to the Gamma radiation and turns into the Hulk. So, as I said, the first two-thirds to three-quarters of the book is very much an origin story for Bruce Banner and what has led him to become the Hulk. The last quarter of the book shows him at crossroads, which is kind of an alternate dimension, a crossroads really of many dimensions of the Marvel Universe. And this is where Doctor Strange transported the Hulk. I think it was issue 299 or 300. So just to give some quick background, last time we saw the Hulk in Secret Wars, he had Banner's intellect, but we saw that he was slowly losing control of that and becoming the kind of the mindless monster once again. And eventually that does happen. And he goes so far to the point of being the mindless Incredible Hulk that Banner is completely submerged and he's not even changing back into Banner. And he's just becoming this engine of destruction. And so in order to prevent loss of life and destruction of property, Doctor Strange transports him to this crossroads area, kind of a limbo where the Hulk can rest until they can and be in more of a benign place until they can find a way to cure him or somehow bring Banner back. So that's where he's been for the last 12 issues, having various adventures, because as I said, this limbo does connect to other dimensions in the Marvel Universe. So we see here, this is the first time we see this idea that, again, Peter David drew upon in his run, that 377 issue, where the Hulk is finally able to, or Banner is finally able to reconcile all these different parts of his personality. So here we see kind of the self-preservation part of his personality, the intellect and reasoning part of his personality, and the rage part of his personality. And they're all embodied by different beings or items that we saw in this origin story of Banner. And finally, through him kind of realizing and externalizing these different parts of his personality, he starts to become aware that they exist, manages to integrate them back into himself, and is able to finally become Bruce Banner again. And he's kind of sitting here in limbo, feeling sorry for himself when the Beyonder shows up. Apparently, the Beyonder's been out on a walkabout. He has realized that there are many more dimensions to this existence and universe and what Earth is. And he's kind of strolling through them and checking them out. He saw Asgard. He saw the domain of Mephisto. He saw the Microverse and the Dark Dimension. And now he's finally at the crossroads. So he's trying to understand Bruce. But again, it's kind of a step back for the Beyonder. He's not interacting on a level where he is human. He's just observing. He's back to his observation mode. And he kind of wonders why there's this person who has all this strength and all this intellect, and instead he's choosing to embrace despair like a lover, and he seems to want to die. As the Beyonder's observing him, he sees in the unimaginable distance a stream of energy that enters the void, and he thinks, I'll help Banner. I will have this energy come toward Banner and meet him. So why exactly? Not sure. But since
that knowledge lies beyond,
right? Banner's thoughts dwell upon his own death, and at the bidding of the one from beyond, the energy stream changes course, heading right toward Banner. So it's kind of ominous, right? Like Bruce is thinking, I want to die, and the Beyonder senses this being of great energy and says, okay, I'm going to help him to die, maybe? I mean, that's not stated necessarily, but it's kind of implied. But you really think if Banner wanted to die and you're the Beyonder and you wanted to help him, why not just kill him yourself?
Just blank him out.
Yeah, if you really want to help. So, again, it doesn't really tie in, although we get on the bottom some text here. He'll help Banner? What does the one from beyond mean by that? And just what is the power and purpose of this now rapidly approaching energy stream? If you read Alpha Flight 28, which also ties into Secret Wars 2, you'll learn more. Also, if you read our next issue of Incredible Hulk, you'll find out still more. And then there's an awesome slam bang conclusion to the entire crossover saga awaiting you in Alpha Flight 29. So, again, this goes back to trying to tie in, like, same thing with the Fantastic Four issues with the Hate Monger. It's like, Alpha Flight 28 is an official crossover, but 29 isn't. And Hulk 312 is an official crossover, but Hulk 313 isn't. But you really need to read all four of those to really get, if you really want to know the story. So again, it's showing the purpose of the crossover from a commercial standpoint of, and we're hoping to get you people hooked into these stories enough that you'll pick up these other issues. So I'm not a big fan of this era of the Hulk. I wasn't a big fan of him being in the crossroads and dealing with Nightmare, the character Nightmare, not the dream state. I just didn't like it. I was very much enjoying Hulk and Hulk with the Banner intellect that we saw from like 265 on. And even after that, when he starts losing control and it's more of the classic Hulk rampaging Thunderbolt Ross and his Hulkbusters trying to catch Hulk, enjoyed that as well. But sticking the Hulk in this weird dimension where he's fighting like weird alien creatures, demon creatures, creatures from other... I just didn't enjoy it. I much more prefer Hulk on Earth. The whole weirdness factor thing with Mignola art, because he can draw weird demons and stuff like that really, really well. It's just not my particular cup of tea. It's not to say that this isn't classic Hulk material, but it just wasn't my favorite era. I remember kind of ducking out on the Hulk for a while and not coming back to it until like the 320-ish era, when Matt Lowe was finally off the book and John Byrne took over just very briefly, and then Peter David started his run. So what were your thoughts on this issue, Nick?
I mostly found it interesting that it looks like he took it too far, because I think Ang Lee took the little Hulk figure around Bruce Banner and assumed the Hulk was always inside him, which is what his movie was. Like, literally, like, it was a gamma bomb that released something that was in him. So I find it interesting that it actually came from comics in some form. Otherwise, yeah, it's kind of like barely a tie-in. I don't even know what the Beyonder's even doing at the end, so, except for realizing Asgard exists.
Exactly. It's tangential at best, but yeah, that's always the whole Ang Lee angst of Bruce Banner has always been a part of his childhood and part of the Hulk history. Like I said, Matt Lowe touches on it, Peter David touched on it, so that part wasn't why that movie was bad.
The movie was just bad.
Yeah, and I didn't mind. I thought Eric Bana, Jennifer Connelly, great casting choices.
Who was Thunderbolt Ross? Was it Sam Elliott?
Yeah, it was Sam Elliott.
Because now it's
William Hurt.
William Hurt, who's really good at him, even though he's still a dick character.
Yeah, but I didn't think Sam Elliott was bad either. So it wasn't. It definitely wasn't the casting, and it was kind of the writing. That, you know, the acting was not that great. But again, if you're not giving the actors anything to work with. And Nick Nolte, no.
Not in this one.
No. Never, ever, no, ever.
And, there's gotta be something good.
And the fact that Banner's dad was dead and has always been for many, many years before he ever became the Hulk. So having him show up, be back alive, and turning
into the Absorbing Man.
And turning into like a cross between the Absorbing Man and Zax. Who was always a Hulk villain, you know, who was basically like a being of living electricity.
Oh, that's how he traveled around. I've only seen the movie once in theaters.
Yeah.
So
same here.
It's been a good, what? I think it was 2003. It's been a while. 15 years.
So bad. Anyway, moving on from that terrible movie to Daredevil 223. As I mentioned before, this is the book that ties in most closely to The Beyonder. And we did see at the end of Secret Wars 3 that The Beyonder planned on going and talking to Matt Murdock and Foggy Nelson, attorneys at law. So he is very much a part of the entire narrative here. So Daredevil 223, written by Denny O'Neil and Jim Shooter. We've got pencils by David Mazzucchelli, inks by Kim DeMolder, and colors by Ken Fadunowitz. So interesting that it's Mazzucchelli, because this art looks like a far cry from Batman Year One, right?
Yeah.
So clearly Mazzucchelli hadn't quite finished developing his style yet. So the story starts out with Matt Murdock's girlfriend's camera getting stolen. She's very distraught, and Matt's just happy that she's okay, and it's just a camera that can be replaced, except that her beloved father gave her that camera, the last thing he gave her before he died. And so Matt, of course, is determined to track the camera down as his alter ego, Daredevil. Next, we see that the Beyonder's floating in space. He's come up with an idea. In Secret Wars 2, number 3, we saw that he took over the world through sheer force of will, and was not satisfied. And has somehow come to the conclusion that satisfaction doesn't come in the doing or the completing of things, but in the trying. So what he decides to do is he's going to take over the world through completely legitimate means. And in order to do that, to take over the world's industries and, you know, commercially and politically, he's going to need some attorneys. So he heads to the law offices of Murdock and Nelson, tells them what he wants, and the guys are having trouble paying their rent. They haven't had many cases lately. Matt comments that he hasn't even been in the office much. And so Foggy's the practical one, you know, and he's like, yes, we will do this for you. Matt, with his senses, clearly is aware something's not right and says, I'm sorry, I don't want to have anything to do with this. So he walks out. The Beyonder, again, trying to do things legitimately, gives the lawyers $1 million retainer, and not just, he doesn't just create gold out of thin air like usual, because he's trying to follow proper channels. He says, this is money which I have just recovered from the safe of a sunken ship, mine by right of salvage, according to your laws. It's $1 million. And Foggy's like, oh my. Meanwhile, the Beyonder has actually split his consciousness. He wants to understand what it is about Matt Murdock, why he doesn't want to help. So, again, he's switched into observation mode. He's got a little Beyonder ghost that's following Daredevil around. Well, Daredevil is out in the streets trying to track down that camera. And while doing so, he's also thinking about why he doesn't want to help the Beyonder. Because he definitely senses that the story the Beyonder told him and Foggy about being able to take over the world through sheer force of will definitely happened. He's like, yeah, I believe what he said, mind-boggling as it was, I sense that he has that power. So Daredevil finds out from a local pawnbroker who probably took the camera and goes to track down the guy's brother, hoping he might have some insight into where he is. His brother works as a janitor at a pesticide or insecticide rather factory. And when he shows up there, just by coincidence, the brother's there. And the janitor, legitimate brother, is going to let him sleep there just for one night. If you're not gone by the morning, I'll call the police. So as Daredevil attempts to swing up to a catwalk above the factory floor, all of a sudden he can see. The Beyonder
I can see!
The Beyonder has decided that he wants to give Matt Murdock a retainer as well. And clearly what will mean more to him than money is sight, right? Because he's been reading Murdock's thoughts all this time, and he kind of understands his motivation. So unfortunately, the ability to see all of a sudden out of nowhere as he's swinging toward this catwalk throws Daredevil off. He bangs into the side of the catwalk, falls into a vat of insecticide. But unlike other stories we've seen where Daredevil has regained his sight to the detriment of his other senses, the Beyonder has managed to restore his sight while Daredevil retains his other super senses. So he hears the hose dripping nearby, because he needs to wash off all the chemicals that are burning his eyes and mouth. He's like, I can hear water dripping. No, I can see it. So he goes over, he rinses it off, and he's like, I can see this must be the Beyonder, the one from beyond. It must be his idea of payment. Meanwhile, we see Foggy in the law library working on the case, and the Beyonder shows up saying, are you progressing? Mr. Beyond, I didn't hear you come in. That's because I didn't. And Foggy's like, I'm doing just fine. It may take years, but I'm going over the laws governing international corporations that might do the trick. Beyonder's like, well, you have years. Meanwhile, several miles downtown, apparently it's now morning again, because it looked like it was night when Daredevil was approaching the factory.
It seemed like it suddenly became night when he was, yeah. I don't remember.
Yeah, when he was going after the pawnbroker and everything.
Yeah, he walks outside, takes off his clothes, and then the next panel, it's nighttime.
Yeah, and now all of a sudden it's day again, and he's staring at a baby like you do when you haven't had sight since you were like 13 years old. And the woman's like, you've been staring at my baby for 5 minutes. Can I help you? No, thank you. A baby. Wow. And so, yeah, he's very disoriented. He can't even really find his way around, even though he's lived in New York his whole life.
And my favorite line is, what are you, blind? Because he's so obsessed looking at other stuff.
Yeah, definitely. He's like, wow, these buildings are extraordinarily tall. You knew they were tall. Just because you were blind, you didn't not know
you were swinging tall. Up there.
Exactly. But yeah, he even thinks to himself, man, funny, sightless. I didn't even have to think about where things were. I moved around by instinct. But now I get so confused because I can see. And he shows up at his girlfriend's house. He's like, oh, you're so beautiful. I didn't realize. Again, he had the radar sense. You know, he could kind of see. I mean, as bad as the Daredevil movie was, it was a cool scene in the rain when it allowed him to kind of see Elektra's face. So, you know, his girlfriend, Gloriana, takes pictures, thus the camera. And so he's looking at her pictures. Wow, your pictures are so beautiful. I didn't know you're so talented. And she's like, why are you looking at pictures? You can finally see, you know, the reality and the real world are actually better than pictures. And it's right out the window, New York City. Let's go check it out. So they spend the day looking at various things, statues and art, paintings, and walking through Central Park and watching the sunset over the harbor. And going to the top of the Empire State Building, and she had mentioned earlier in the day about, will you ever tell me how you regain your sight? He's like, maybe someday, maybe years from now. And he's overwhelmed with the sight of New York City at night, and he starts crying. Like, Matthew, what's wrong? Why are you weeping? And he's like, I'd forgotten, you know, I was so young when I lost my sight. Everything's so beautiful. And Gloriana starts talking about how there's so many other things to see, storms in the mountains, dawn over the Acropolis, the Caribbean Sea, and Matt says no. She's like, I beg your pardon? Sorry, I've got to leave. I've got to see a client. But Matt, at this hour? Yes, I must. I'll see you. No, I'll be with you later. And he leaves. And he puts on his Daredevil costume, and he's standing on top of a building, screaming into the storm. I know you're omnipotent. I know you can hear me. I need to speak with you right now. You know, the longer I have my sight back, the plainer it is that I value it too much. I'd do anything to keep it. And that's what worries me, because the Beyonder himself mentioned the profound sense of justice that Matt Murdock has. And he's worried. He doesn't trust himself that he has sight, that he might compromise that sense of justice. He might pervert it if something were to threaten his sight. So he wants the Beyonder to remove the retainer. The Beyonder's like, okay, I release you, but keep the sight as a gift. And Matt Murdock says, no, take it back. Take it back or I'll sue. I mean, that's the whole point, right? I don't want this sight. It's too much of a temptation. And Foggy ends up giving up as well. He says, I guess Matt was right. it just won't work. There's no legitimate way to take over the world. And then the Beyonder goes back to the pesticide factory, insecticide factory, finds the guy that...
Daredevil.
What's that?
Daredevil, not the Beyonder.
Daredevil, right. Sorry. Daredevil goes back, finds the guy that stole the camera, and takes it back and says... the woman you stole this from says that she uses this camera to catch a little of the world that she describes as grand and glorious, and I know exactly what she means. I know. And the book ends. So, interesting take. As I said, the Beyonder is very much an integral part of this story. I don't know that I agree with Matt, because what kind of person would that make him if he, you know, at some point was forced to choose between saving a life or losing his sight again? I guess when you've been without something for so long, maybe you would come to covet it too much. But give yourself a break, man. It's been one day. Like, maybe you could go a week with the eyesight and then see how you feel. But Matt Murdock is an interesting character. Daredevil's not one of my favorite characters in Marvel Universe, and he's definitely been written over the years a little, I don't want to say inconsistently, but he's had times where he's been more of an avenging devil, avenging angel, if you will. Other times where he's been more on the straight and narrow, gotta follow the law, just based on some of the things that have been thrown at him. I kind of feel like he's Hal Jordan of the Marvel Universe in a way. Hal Jordan's the guy in the DC Universe that they've really put through the ringer, you know, destroyed his whole hometown of Coast City, you know, killed all the people he cared about, turned him into a villain, turned him into the Spectre, back to being a hero, found out he was possessed by Parallax, like all these different things that they've, you know, all the hoops and terrible stuff they've put him through, and he's remained a hero. Daredevil's kind of that in the Marvel Universe, you know. You know, Karen Page was his girlfriend for a long time. They hooked her on drugs. They, you know, the Kingpin exposed Matt Murdock's secret identity. He lost his law license, you know, lost his business, lost Foggy Nelson as a friend. Like, they've really put him through the ringer over the years. He's in some ways a tragic figure. And here he's doing it to himself, man. It's just like he won't let himself be happy. Almost like Batman that we saw the story recently, where he's not allowed to be happy.
Well, I kind of like this issue because it reminds me. I like that the Beyonder is kind of giving different heroes, having them question themselves. Like, this reminds me of Spider-Man getting the golden notebook and being like, should I take it? Yeah, I think I should take it. This is kind of like he's causing them accidentally to question their morals, which I like.
Yeah, that's true. It's very...
He's not even intending to.
Yeah, it's very much a late 80s comic thing to do, right? Like, trying to blur those lines between right and wrong. I will say this about Matt Murdock. Throughout everything he's been through, he has, for the most part, remained heroic, which you wouldn't necessarily think is the case with everything he's been put through. What did you think of the art? Because, like I said, it's David Mazzucchelli, who's kind of obtained legendary status at this point with the work he did on Year One with Frank Miller. But here, very different style.
It looks very much like, I don't know. I have way more trouble with the 80s art distinguishing artists than I do with the current art even. Because all these Marvel books kind of have a very similar... And DC too. It's like it's all the very 80s style. So like I didn't really know. I like the way he draws Daredevil and my like intense red that breaks up some pages. But otherwise, I didn't really notice.
Yeah. Part of the reason the style looks so similar too is just the way the printing is so similar at this time.
Yeah.
On the newsprint. The colors are, you know, not as bright and vibrant on the better paper, so.
He gets really good red Daredevil in the last page, though, especially the close-up on his eyes. He's like, I know.
Yeah, it was an interesting story. I actually had never read this this issue of Daredevil, which surprised me when I read it. So, kind of interesting. But again, yeah, I do feel like Matt took a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to the site. But I mean, I guess... Maybe he was scared, you know, that he really would be willing to do anything to maintain the site. So you got to have respect for that. Anything else we want to say about any of these issues?
No, I'm excited to see how wacky Secret Wars 3. That's next, right? Secret Wars 3. It's
4.
Or 4? 4. Yeah, oh, yeah. Number 4. We're getting in there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it really starts kind of seeing where the story's going with the next issue. All right. Well, that's it for the books this week. I did want to mention one other thing. As we record this, so Steve Ditko passed away.
Yeah.
Legend in the industry. You know, this guy co-created Spider-Man. And beyond co-creating Spider-Man, like, you have to understand just how much the artist from those early Marvel books contributed to the creative process because of the Marvel Method. For those not familiar, the Marvel Method. So a paragraph or two about Stanley would write saying, this is what I want this issue to be about. You know, it wasn't a script, a full script, the way comic collaborators and writers work now, or the way DC did it, where it was a writer saying, page one, panel one, here's what happens. Page two, or page one, panel two, here's what happens. Page three, panel, or page one, panel three, here's what happened. Page one, panel four, here's what happened, right? Like breaking down each panel and letting them know and giving them descriptions. Here's what the villain should look like. Here's what the hero should look like. Here's what the action should look like in the panel. Here's what the dialogue should look like in the panel. So where it's very much the writer kind of spoon feeding the artist. No, the Marvel Method was, okay, in this story, Spider-Man fights a villain who has mechanical arms and has trouble finding a date and goes to dinner with his Aunt May. Go draw the story. And it was up to the artist to create, decide how many panels on each page, what's in each panel. Let me draw this story and then give the story back to Stan Lee. And Stan Lee would go in and put in the words, the script. You know, okay, Peter Parker says this in this panel. Aunt May says this in this panel. So that was the Marvel Method, right? It allowed Stan Lee to tell a lot of stories because he only had to write a paragraph or two. And the artists were handing a lot of the heavy lifting. So when to say Steve Ditko created Spider-Man, it wasn't just that he drew Spider-Man. He really was a co-creator of these stories because Stan wasn't giving him full scripts. So when you talk about not even just creating Spider-Man, but the fact that he created all those early Spider-Man villains.
Mm-hmm.
Green Goblin.
Doc Ock.
Octopus.
Sandman. Mysterio, Vulture.
Sandman. Vulture. The Enforcers. Like all
the classics.
All these characters, right? So, and then beyond that, Hawk and Dove, The Question, my favorite Steve Ditko creation, The Creeper, and one that I think often gets overlooked is Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange is the one they mentioned the most in like tweets I saw last night, because now he's getting recognition for that. Now he's a big character in the movies.
Because Ditko had such a quirky style. He was so adept at drawing like magical dimensions and beings. And he had that very contortionist style of drawing Spider-Man, that kind of freewheeling style that was a bit cartoonish, but also was so suited to drawing these mystical dimensions and drawing these, the magic of Doctor Strange. And so, yeah, I think he was a master storyteller, much like Kirby. I think as a early comic reader in my, I wasn't even 10 yet when I first discovered Kirby and Ditko. It was probably around 7 or 8. I wasn't a big fan of their art because it wasn't as clean as I was used to. So it took me quite a few years before I was able to appreciate their storytelling style. If I would say anything about what Kirby's art really brought to the page, it was a sense of power. And cosmic, and what Ditko's art brought was really a sense of movement, of kind of a kinetic feel, and of that quirkiness and that weirdness that so suited things like Doctor Strange and the Creeper. So we really lost a legend.
Absolutely.
I don't think it can be overstated how much Ditko really added to the medium and how many artists nowadays and creators, not just artists, but writers as well, have been influenced by him, his storytelling style, and all of the so many of the characters that he created.
Mm-hmm. I would say the films right now are leaning towards Kirby, Ditko, and I forgot what I was going to say. Like, they're really aiming towards that kind of look recently, where they've been incorporating more of their stuff than ever. Like, the weird, bizarre stuff. So, it's been fun.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So, as always, we want to thank you all for joining us. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or whatever platform you use to find past episodes of the podcast. Also, the ratings really help with our ability to reach new readers and visibility, especially 5-star ratings on iTunes. Kind of raises our podcast up the list when people search for comic book podcasts. So we really appreciate those. In addition to all those platforms, you can also find past episodes at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, you can check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. In less than 2 weeks, we will be at San Diego Comic-Con. Manny and I will be there covering a massive show. So many good panels announced already. I'm not sure. I'm really wishing I was multiple man at this point, so I could split myself into many different people and cover the show as I would like to. Do the best I can to bring you a lot of content and a lot of interviews. But I just can't get even like I've only looked at Thursday and Friday, and there's already so many panels that either overlap completely or overlap partially with other panels. So, I mean, there are so many great panels at San Diego. I literally could be just in panels all day and not even be on the floor. So I'm gonna do the best I can to cover as much as I can for all of you. If you're going to be there, let us know. Reach out on one of those social media platforms. We'd love to meet up with you, take a picture, hook you up with the Comic Source lanyard. So once again, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.